Okay, thank you guys very much. This project has been a long time in the making. It's evolved a lot. I think it still may have a ways to go. If nothing else, it needs to be tightened up a little bit. The seed of the paper has remained pretty much consistent throughout, however. I can trace it back to the first time that I read, and really the first time also that I taught at Water v. Lago Vista. And I puzzled over how the court could declare at once an arrest to be, in their language, a gratuitous humiliation and also a pointless indignity, but also constitutionally reasonable. So to very briefly recap for you guys the facts of Atwater, a police officer named Turek stops Gail Atwater as she drives her pickup through her hometown with her two young children, none of them buckled up. And instead of issuing Miss Atwater a citation or a warning, Turek summarily arrests her. In fact, he doesn't even allow her to take the two young children to a friend's home just half a block down the road. In the court's eyes, and in almost everyone's eyes who's evaluated the case, the officer, the court's language, behaved badly. He exercised extremely poor judgment. We might even say that he acted like an obdurate bully. And so by any common sense measure, the arrest was unreasonable, except not by a constitutional measure. Rather, what the court held is that an arrest is reasonable as long as it is supported by probable cause. That is, probable cause operates as a hard proxy for constitutional reasonableness. Now, over time, I think I've come to understand better what motivated the court, its jurisprudential approach, even as I continue to disagree with it. I think the case is a product of the court's hard commitment to the legality principle within the special domain of the criminal law. That is, the court believes that the consequences of criminal enforcement, punishment, prosecution, they're so profound that state discretion must be cabined by clear lines. And I think that much is right. I think that much is fairly uncontroversial. What I puzzle about, what I wonder about, is the next step. Why the court feels that legalistic constraints on executive discretion are not just necessary in the special domain of criminal law, but they're also sufficient. The court has determined that a hard commitment to legality is not some supplement to particularistic constraints, other constraints that would typically apply to state actors under the Fourth Amendment. Rather, these legalistic constraints are substitutes for those other constraints. The court has made the quantitative measure of technical guilt accuracy embodied by the probable cause standard the entire measure of Fourth Amendment reasonableness, and all qualitative considerations in the process have fallen away. Okay. In the piece, what I do to underscore this point is I line up, I compare the court's Fourth Amendment jurisprudential approach to law enforcement cases, cases like Atwater, with its jurisprudential approach to non-law enforcement cases, to which I ascribe the somewhat unsatisfying catch-all moniker, peacekeeping cases. In peacekeeping cases, the court does something fairly radically different. What the court has said, again, in its terms, is that reasonableness in peacekeeping cases is measured by common sense and ordinary human experience, not by rigid criteria. This methodological approach is sometimes called general reasonableness. It consists of an all things considered balance to determine whether a peacekeeping search or seizure is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. As part of this balance, the court looks at the state interest and balances the state's interest against the individual's interest. I examine one case in particular, which I think it lines up or compares nicely with Atwater. That being Safford v. Redding. And notably, it's a Souter decision, and I remark on that because Souter is actually the justice who wrote Atwater as well. So in Safford, the court held unconstitutional a strip search by school safety administrators of a 13-year-old girl suspected of possessing prescription-strength ibuprofen. Here, the court doesn't use a quantitative measure as a proxy for constitutional reasonableness. Instead, the court considers the whole context. It doesn't ask just whether the police or the school administrators here, so police in the general sense of the word, had sufficient reason to suspect the girl of possessing the contraband. They asked whether it was otherwise qualitatively unreasonable to engage in a strip search, and they decided that yes, indeed, it was qualitatively unreasonable because it was an unnecessary humiliation. So here it mattered quite a lot that the search was no more than a pointless indignity. So a comparison of the two cases, I think, reveals what a hard commitment to legality can miss out upon. It can miss out upon other considerations of principle and policy. I focus narrowly on one such principle, which I call the dignity principle. I borrow the principle and, indeed, the definition of principle from Dworkin. Dworkin talks about a right, what he called a core liberal right, to equal concern and respect. And I also think that there is a right embedded in what I call the dignity principle to dignified treatment. And I think we see this right pervade much of public and private law, albeit often implicitly. I think you can see strands of it throughout the law. This is the particularistic principle, or this is one of the particularistic principles that falls by the wayside in Atwater and other law enforcement cases like it. Atwater takes a very narrow view of what is arbitrary state treatment. I would submit that that treatment can be arbitrary where it is undignified, where it fails to satisfy particularistic principles like the dignity principle. But for the court, only one kind of arbitrariness matters. That's technical legal inaccuracy. The paradox, then, what we see happening, which is kind of odd, is that particularistic principles like dignity generate the least force in constitutional doctrine in the very domain where the state acts most forcefully, that is, within the domain of criminal law and law enforcement. So this is where I think Atwater has run off the rails. I don't think it had to be this way. I think the court could have honored concurrently the legality principle and other principles. It could have affirmed legalistic thresholds like probable cause, but supplemented those thresholds at least some of the times, with an all things considered balance to reasonableness. Now, I think the best argument against my position, there's a few, but I think the best is that the rule of law, in fact, commands an exclusive focus on formal measures like probable cause. But I offer reasons to doubt that claim, reasons to conclude instead that consistency, predictability, transparency, and other rule of law values are not obviously facilitated by mechanistic approaches. Indeed, some of these reasons for pause have already been explored in great detail within the overcriminalization literature. The problem is identified by people like Bill Stuntz, is that once these legalistic hurdles are satisfied, police and prosecutors are thereafter free. They have almost unfettered discretion to pick and choose for good and bad normative reasons between technically legally guilty offenders. And there are lots of such offenders to choose from because substantive criminal codes are so broad. So there are a lot of people out there who are probably legally guilty of something. In this way, it may be that a hard dependence on the legality principle does more to establish safe harbors, zones of sovereign prerogative, zones for unfettered choice, than to constrain problematic exercises of discretion. in addition to this substantive domain of choice that I described and that's been explored before, I add to that literature by discussing a procedural domain of choice, a phenomenon that I call spillover deference, whereby law enforcers actually make pick and choose between a sort of peacekeeping approach to reasonableness and a law enforcement approach to reasonableness, and they may use their peacekeeping authority as a pretext to expand their case-making authority, their law enforcement authority. So I hope that by the time you get to the end of my piece, you don't read it as something that's saying, hey, there are rule of law cost here, but kind of rule of law cost be darned. I think there are other values that are more important. I actually think that my approach may operate in service to the rule of law, that a robust fidelity to the demands of the rule of law demand a more dynamic approach than what we find under prevailing doctrine. I think there's a place for categorical constraints on executive discretion, and there's also a place for supplemental particularistic constraints, at least in certain normatively appropriate circumstances. And I think each type of constraint can be implemented without polluting the other type, as long as courts are honest and forthright about what they're doing and when they're doing it. And such a dynamic approach can even allow us to constrain different institutional actors in different ways, something that we don't see under contemporary doctrine. A court might conclude, for instance, that it's reasonable for a peace officer to engage in a peacekeeping search, but not to use the fruits of that peacekeeping search to build a criminal case. Or in another context, the court might say, you know, it's okay for a case maker to build a case based on what started as a peacekeeping search. Or a court could conclude that it's reasonable to allow a police officer even to arrest for a trivial offense where there's probable cause, but to say, you know what, the arrest is permissible, but to allow the prosecutor to build a criminal case thereafter is not. Okay, I've already spoken for more than long enough. I'm more interested in your comments and questions. I'm especially curious about whether you think I've appropriately identified and sketched this dignity principle that I talk about. There are parts of the paper where I had to move somewhat far afield from my typical subject matter area, not just into moral philosophy, but as you can see, I even touch on torts and contracts. So I'm really curious whether you think I got all that right. I'm also curious whether you all can signal other lines of comparison, other fields of analogy that I've wholly missed. So with that, please fire away.